Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Monday, the 22nd of June. Today, signs that the Iranian authorities have successfully quashed the wave of protests over the disputed election, sending a new chill to relations with the West.
What the regime is now doing, it's done it before. The well-tried tactic is trying to externalise the problem and projecting it onto international powers, particularly the United States and Britain.
Also today, the World Bank sets out how the global recession has hit developing countries.
Only $360 billion of private sector capital will flow into them this year. That's half of what happened in 2008 and a quarter of what happened in 2007.
And evidence of a plot as MPs elect a new common speaker.
That's the sort of thing that gives Parliament a terribly bad name, you know, fixing a game for people who don't want sort of massive change after the expenses scandal.
First, the headlines and a flick through today's papers with Bill Overton.
MPs will elect a new Speaker of the Commons today amid claims party whips are plotting against each other to install their own preferred candidates. Former Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett's being tipped as the front-runner after Conservative MP John Bercow, previously the hot favourite, appeared to lose ground. Tories are said to be manoeuvring behind Sir George Young, the chairman of the Standards and Privileges Committee. The former Speaker, Michael Martin, quit during the heat of the scandal surrounding MPs' expenses. The street protests in Iran disputing the results of the presidential election have fallen quiet after a government crackdown that peaked with the death of at least 10 protesters on Saturday. A behind-the-scenes struggle among Iran's ruling clerics has been revealed. The government says it's arrested the daughter and other relatives of the former president Hashemi Rafsanjani, an Ayatollah who is one of the country's most powerful men. They've now been released. Mr. Rafsanjani appeared to be aligning himself with the opposition. The identity of the bodies of two Britons who were held hostage in Iraq and handed over to the British Embassy have been revealed. Jason Creswell of Glasgow and Jason Swindlehurst from Lancashire were two of five British security guards who were kidnapped 2 years ago. Speculation over the condition of the three Britons still being held hostage has intensified. Gordon Brown last night sent his condolences to the families of the two dead men. Greenpeace activists have boarded a ship delivering coal to the King's North power station in Kent. The environmental group says nine protesters managed to board the ship in order to prevent it from unloading its cargo. The ship has now docked. Five people were arrested. And Zimbabwean Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai will visit Gordon Brown to ask for financial support to help rebuild his country. Mr. Tsvangirai says the Zimbabwean government has made progress with reform since he entered a power-sharing deal with President Robert Mugabe in February. And now a look at today's papers. The whispers of a plot in Westminster over the election of the new Commons Speaker provide loud headlines. The Daily Telegraph talks of the secret bid to install the former Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett as the Speaker, while the Times accuses party whips of fixing today's vote. Hope was lost on Father's Day, according to The Sun. Alongside photos of the two British security guards who died in Iraq while being held, The Independent says the two men were failed by the Foreign Office. The head of the Royal Bank of Scotland will receive a £9.6 million pay package. The Financial Times says the chief exec, Stephen Hester, is being rewarded for securing support for an incentive plan for shareholders. And this year, the Home Office will issue 220,000 passports to migrants. That's speculation from the Daily Mail. Those are the headlines today. There's more news updated throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
After Iran's most serious internal conflict since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, yesterday President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad called on Western countries, including the United States and Britain, to stop interfering in the Republic's internal affairs. His main opponent, Mir Hossein Mousavi, maintains the vote was rigged. But with the official death toll after a week of unrest now at 20, there was little sign yesterday of last week's mass demonstrations. Our foreign affairs specialist, Simon Tisdall, assesses the impact on the resolve of the opposition of the hard-line stance of Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei.
The supreme leader basically gave the opposition an ultimatum on Friday, which is basically knock it off or else it's going to get very serious on the streets. And that's what happened Saturday. That's what happened when demonstrators did try to start gathering for what had been scheduled to be another really big demonstration The security forces were out in strength, up to 30,000 men, military, besieged militia, police and so on. And they stopped large groups forming more or less successfully. The opposition leaders were also in a terrible dilemma because they knew if they called their supporters onto the streets, they'd be held responsible potentially for the bloodshed that ensued, and that would be on their heads. And they knew that this is no longer just a question of arguing about the election results. They would actually be challenging the authority of the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic. In other words, it would be a direct challenge to the legitimacy of the regime, which is probably further than Mousavi, the main reformist leader, wanted to go.
And Rafsanjani, the other key figure in this, he so far remained silent.
Rafsanjani is thought to be manoeuvring behind the scenes. In fact, analysts like me rather think that he's been behind a lot of this. He was instrumental in picking Mir Hossein Mousavi as the candidate for the reformist opposition earlier this year, when at that time it seemed that Mohamed Khatami, the former president, was going to run. But he stood down in favour of Mousavi, and that seems to have been something that Rafsanjani engineered. There was also a story that Rafsanjani had done a deal with the supreme leader that that if they didn't put up Khatami, the reformist, as their candidate, but somebody else, then the supreme leader wouldn't overtly lean towards or favour Ahmadinejad. But if that deal was struck, it wasn't kept, because the supreme leader has been very overt in his support for the president, both before and after the election. So Rafsanjani, if he isn't manoeuvring, has not been very successful. Also, it appears now some members of his family, some of his children, may have been arrested. Some of them, including his son, were involved in organising the campaign for Mousavi, which Rafsanjani bankrolled. So it may be that he's under personal pressure now to knock it off.
And there's been a war of words between the regime and Western countries.
Well, this is now potentially the most damaging aspect of this story in terms of what happens next. I think, barring some unforeseen developments, and of course it's very unpredictable still, in terms of what's happening on the street, this story is now coming to a close. The security forces have made it quite clear they are capable of shutting down effective protest, at least in the short term. But what the regime is now doing, it's done it before, it's a well-tried tactic, is trying to externalise the problem, is projecting it onto international powers, particularly the United States and Britain, and claiming to its own people and to the region that they were responsible for fomenting this unrest. In fact, it wasn't a spontaneous challenge to the regime, that it was, in fact, a got-up foreign plot. And Britain in particular has been chastised for its alleged role in this.
Simon Tisdall, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/Iran. Also on The Guardian's website today, Cole Morton considers the rise of paganism. That's at guardian.co.uk/G2. As work commences on Southend Pier, our architecture and design critic Jonathan Glancy celebrates the wonder of the British Pier at guardian.co.uk/culture. And Jermaine Greer looks at political lampooning through the ages. That's at guardian.co.uk/politics. Africa and Eastern Europe are being hit hardest by the global recession, according to a report published today by the World Bank. It calls for greater international cooperation and tighter regulation of the global financial system. With the details, economics correspondent Ashley Seeger.
It tells us how developing countries are bearing the brunt of the global financial crisis, because it's estimating that only $360 billion of private sector capital will flow into them this year. That's half of what happened in 2008 and a quarter of what happened in 2007 at the peak of the world economy.
So what we already knew, I suppose, is that the poorest people in the world are going to get hit hardest by the recession.
Yes, we suspected that was the case, although for many economists the argument was that these countries had decoupled from America and Britain and Europe and were a powerhouse of their own. That's proven to be, unfortunately, not the case at all.
And which areas of the world are going to be particularly hardest hit?
Sub-Saharan Africa, as usual. In fact, Sub-Saharan Africa has been something of a success story in recent years, growing at nearly 6% a year. Now it'll slow to 1% this year, the World Bank estimates. Latin America quite hard hit as well. Central and Eastern Europe and Central Asia very hard hit as well.
And this report comes out just a few days before a UN conference later this week in New York on the global financial crisis, but there's no UK minister attending.
Yes, it's bizarre, and this is what charities are drawing our attention to today. They're very cross about this. They're saying Gordon Brown held a G20 meeting earlier in the year. He always goes to the G8 and argues for a better deal for poor countries, and yet the UN holds a big conference later this week and he's not even sending a cabinet-level minister. So charities are very cross.
And what's the British government saying about this?
Well, the British government's saying that the G20 is the appropriate forum, that they've pushed for and successfully pushed for at the G20 a large increase in funding towards poor countries, and that they're doing the best they can. And in fact, Britain is a good egg on this, if you'll pardon the expression, on development and so forth, because we are actually one of the few countries in the G8 or amongst the world's industrial countries that are increasing our aid flows.
And what's your take, Ashley, on the speed with which the world can recover from the recession?
I think it's very slow. I think the banking system remains fairly badly locked up. Trade flows are very weak. Many countries have had a huge drop in industrial output. Now, this has had a lot of stimulus thrown at it. A lot of central banks have cut interest rates, a lot of run a deficit to pump money into their economies. So we seem to have averted the worst. We seem to have stopped contracting. But I don't see the conditions in place for a rapid rebound, I have to say.
Ashley Seeger. My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, tennis correspondent Steve Bearley looks at Andy Murray's prospects at Wimbledon, now that last year's champion, Rafael Nadal, has dropped out.
Andy was in the same side of the draw as Nadal, and he's now the top seed in that half, and in that respect, seeded to meet Federer in the final.
But first, since 2002, 115 Britons have committed suicide with the assistance of the Dignitas Clinic in Switzerland. Well, today the Guardian reveals the medical conditions from which they suffered when they ended their lives. The Observer's health correspondent is Dennis Campbell.
This is a list of 114 of the 115 Britons who have so far travelled to Zurich and killed themselves with the aid of Dignitas, the suicide clinic over there. It tells us exactly what medical condition they had which impelled them to go from Britain to Zurich to end their lives, and which also crucially persuaded Dignitas that their conditions were so bad that they deserved Dignitas's help, because Dignitas don't help absolutely anybody. Some people they reject on medical grounds, but Dignitas and the doctors they use approved these medical conditions, some of which are terminal and some of which appear not to be.
This was already a very emotive issue, of course, but I think, you know, the fact that so many of these people who have died at Dignitas did not have life-threatening issues does raise interesting and complex ethical issues.
Very much so. I mean, right to die flares up as an issue fairly regularly. It's very much in the news at the moment again, because the British Medical Association is due to debate it in about 10 days' time at its annual conference, with quite a lot of doctors saying, you know, we should bring in a right of assisted dying in this country. Every time a high-profile case happens of someone visiting Dignitas, it brings it up again. This list, I think, is a very sort of significant contribution to that debate, because I think for doctors to whom I showed it said, well, this first of all sheds light on exactly what medical criteria Dignitas use or indeed don't use, in other words, where Dignitas draw their own line in the sand. But ethically, even people like Dignity in Dying, the London-based campaign group, who support, in principle, a right of assisted dying, well, they say they're surprised to see some of these conditions on there, and some of them clearly weren't terminal, and even they have sort of concerns that people with non-terminal conditions have been allowed to die at this clinic.
We already knew that some Britons had gone to Dignitas without life-threatening conditions, didn't we?
We had the case a few months ago, late last year, of Daniel James, the young rugby player, 23-year-old, who was very severely disabled, paralysed by a rugby training accident. He went at the age of 23, accompanied by his mum and his dad. He made no bones about it, nor did they. He was rendered tetraplegic. No doctor would say that tetraplegia of itself is necessarily a terminal or fatal condition. So no, he is the most conspicuous so far. Most of the others we've known about have been people with motor neuron disease, various forms of cancer, other conditions which clearly are terminal. This list does help show the extent of people going with non-terminal conditions, and as I said, where dignitas, you know, draw their line in the sand.
Dennis Campbell. MPs elect a new Commons Speaker today to replace Michael Martin. There are 10 candidates, and whoever wins will play a key role in restoring Parliament's reputation in the wake of the expenses scandal. The election process is complicated, and our Westminster correspondent David Henke says there's evidence of a plot to prevent the most radical reformer, the Tory John Bercow, being elected.
There seems to be a sort of unseemly alliance between junior whips in the Labour Party and the Tory Party to unseat the most reformist of the Speaker candidates, who is John Bercow, from getting elected today. And basically what is appears to be happening is that a lot of Tories are being told, vote for Margaret Beckett and joining in with some Labour MPs on this side, get her a big vote, and then at the last minute switch to the one Tory that's not Bercow, with the aim of making sure Bercow isn't in the runoff. And it's a really it's the sort of thing that gives Parliament a terribly bad name, you know, fixing again for people who don't want a sort of massive change after the expenses scandal. And certainly there's a lot of talk, and it's been confirmed by both Labour and Tory sources that this is going on.
Well, the last thing Parliament needs at the moment is any further whiff of scandal, because the next Speaker is going to need to restore trust in Parliament, and the candidates themselves are under particular pressure to be squeaky clean on expenses, aren't they?
Yes, and the problem is that a lot of them, unfortunately, have been exposed. I mean, yesterday in the Sunday Telegraph, had a go at the leading candidates, Bercow, Beckett and Alan Beath, whose tactics is he knows he won't be top of the poll, but hopes to hang on in until enough people have switched so he might win in the last moment. And frankly, this again looks as though, you know, Parliament's electing one of their own who's going to not push through reforms. The other point has been made to me that 7 out of the 10 candidates are over 65. There's very little young blood. I mean, Bercow is younger, under 50, and the youngest one is Parmjot Dhanda, who's an interesting candidate because he is the only one from an ethnic minority. And people who attended the hustings said he came off best as a breath of fresh air, but no one thinks he's going to have enough votes from MPs to get there.
It is a secret ballot though, isn't it? So hopefully that will avert some of the more sort of nefarious tactics in this election.
Yes, it's much better than last time, that when Mike Martin was elected, it was a public vote. And frankly, this was seen as totally disastrous. So the secret ballot may well mean that Tories are being put under pressure to vote for a Labour speaker to stop Bercow, may in the privacy of the polling booths actually not follow that pressure because they know that they won't be able to check up on them. So there is a chance that this unseemly plot may be partially derailed by a decent piece of democracy.
David Henke. Wimbledon fortnight begins today, and there's already been high drama with Friday's surprise withdrawal of last year's champion Rafael Nadal because of a knee injury. Tennis correspondent Steve Bearley says it's advantage Murray.
Oh, completely. Nadal's early loss at the French Open completely changed that tournament because Federer could suddenly see that the one major to elude him was there for the taking. I mean, he was very nervous, but he duly went on and did it. And I think once he knew that Rafa had pulled out of this, he must have thought, well, I'm going to break Pete Sampras's record.
And obviously it improves dramatically Andy Murray's chances.
Well, of course it does, yes. I mean, Andy was in the same side of the draw as Nadal, and he's now the top seed in that half, and in that respect, seeded to meet Federer in the final. I mean, you know, what could be better? Federer going for his 15th slam, Murray trying to overturn 73 years of history, you know, become the first British man since Fred Perry in 1936 to win the title.
Enormous pressure on him, of course. But what about...
Not much.
what about further down the list, Steve? I mean, is there any surprises that you think we might see early on this tournament?
It's quite well, surprises you may get early on in the tournament, although actually men's tennis is quite static at the moment. The top four, obviously Nadal isn't here, would be him, Federer, Andy, and Novak Djokovic. All those below that really have not sort of hit any great heights. That's not to say there aren't players there that could do it. I mean, obviously Andy Roddick has played a couple of finals here, and he's such a big server, a big hitter of the ball. He's always dangerous on grass. Fernando Verdasco, the Spaniard who knocked Andy out in the fourth round of the Australian Open, is another player that could get on a run. He's another left-hander like Nadal, which always makes him that little bit more awkward. So there's a couple of possibilities.
Any predictions for the women's tournament?
The women's tournament is totally and utterly wide open, and so will be, without a shadow of doubt, an All-Williams final.
And then we've got the added pleasure this year of the retractable roof.
We have.
And you haven't seen it yet in action, though, Steve.
I wasn't there. I was in Madrid on the day that the roof was used for the first time, when Andre Agassi and Steffi, his wife, and Tim Henman and Kim Clijsters played. So, no, I haven't. I'm really looking forward to it. You know, press that button and over it rolls. Well, that's a theory anyway.
Steve, many thanks. Roxanne Escobales produced today's edition of Guardian Daily single-handed. And I'm John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.